Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at Beetlejuice, the new Tim Burton feature, which, listen, I talked a lot of smack about Tim Burton making another Beetlejuice movie. I'm looking forward to walking back some of those comments in our review. Stick around for it. We're also going to take a look at Rebel Ridge, this new Netflix feature that we didn't really keep an eye on, but was starting to gain traction this week. We watched it. Definitely some stuff worth seeing in this movie. Aaron Pierre might be a star. We're going to take a look at some upcoming trailers. Some things got announced since our hiatus last week. You might want to keep an eye on, including that Minecraft movie trailer. We're going to get to the Minecraft movie trailer. I promise. We're going to talk about it. Before we get to everything, we need to talk about the news. Our first story this week, Jurassic World Rebirth is here, Andy. Bum, bum, ba, ba. Universal's dinosaur series just won't die. There's a new Jurassic World film coming called Jurassic World Rebirth. We got a first look starring Scarlett Johansson and Jonathan Bailey of Bridgerton fame. Andy, what do you know about what the future of the Jurassic World franchise? Where are we headed? What's coming?
So we finally got some details about this, along with some stills of Jurassic Park of Scarlett Johansson in the bush, in the shrub, and also with Mahershala Ali is also in this, his first film since like 2019. With him holding the iconic flare and looking really scared. So this is going to take, this is continuing the Jurassic Park / Jurassic World story. This is going to take 5 years, take place 5 years after the previous film. And in the last three, they had this thing where the dinosaurs had escaped and kind of taken over the entire Earth. And now they're actually getting away from that, saying that all the dinosaurs have died because they basically can't live in the varying climate, and so there's just a few dinosaurs left on some strategic isolated islands. And they've also discovered that there's some of these dinosaurs have kind of mystical healing powers in their blood and DNA, and so they're sending a team headed by Scarlett Johansson, who's like a co-op, basically playing Black Widow, who's a covert operative, coming to, you know, aid a team of scientists on a set of three islands to get the DNA. And so that's, it's kind of, it sounds a little bit like a superhero movie setup. It definitely is. But they got a good excuse to get back on the island to go after the dinosaurs. Gareth Edwards is directing this, who of course most recently did The Creator, which we did enjoy part of visually. That film looked really good. And this is supposed to come out next summer, summer 2025. So that's what we know so far.
Definitely some talent behind this one. ScarJo was a big get. Obviously, Jonathan Bailey out of Bridgerton, Mahershala Ali back on screen. Looking forward to what he's doing, especially since he's not busy shooting Disney's Blade. And Gareth Edwards, director of The Creator and Rogue One, stepping in to pick up the Jurassic World franchise is going to be good stuff, because Gareth Edwards is very good at shooting sci-fi and he's very good at shooting scale, especially in the jungle. Like, he just kind of seems to be the perfect hit for this. I think if anything, since Universal posted about this on the 29th, people have been quick to point out that this is just simply another Jurassic World film. I don't know if people expected like a leap, like Jurassic Park to Jurassic World and then Jurassic World to Jurassic Earth, or I don't know, something
Universe.
More, yeah, than just what feels like Jurassic World 4, you know. I think that leap originally from Jurassic Park to Jurassic World felt big as far as the movies are going, and showed that there was a big creative difference between these kind of sets of trilogies. This, for what it's worth, seems like it's going to be something new. I like that they're going back to an island, but also like, who's excited about Jurassic World 4? And you have been pointing out off mic, and I think this is a point worth making on the show, and I'm going to make it for you, because God forbid I just let you say your piece. like, they've got this funny run next summer. It's looking like it's going to be, what, Jurassic World, and then Superman from DC, and then Fantastic Four, all right next to each other within like 3 weeks of one another. Like, somebody's going to suffer, right?
Yeah, and it's not going to be Jurassic World, Jurassic Park. This franchise is, you can just bet on it. People love dinosaurs. They love the action. I think Gareth Edwards will bring a really interesting eye, and if they can get a little bit more meaty of story. But, I mean, like, kids love the dinosaurs. This movie is not going to suffer. And it comes out 4th of July weekend 2025. It's going to be a huge hit. They have nothing to worry about. It will be interesting to see ScarJo kind of take the lead or be a lead in this. along with Mahershala Ali is also on her team. So we'll see. I'm sure, you know, it's very similar setup to the original where we have the interests of the scientists who want to create this healing drug. We have the pharmaceutical people who just want to make money off of it. And so it's very similar. It echoes the first one in a lot of ways. I'm sure it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm sure it's going to make a ton of money.
Yeah, I think this movie will do great. We will talk about it again when we get a full trailer and a later Trailer Park segment down the line. If you want to hear that, subscribe to Offscript, and we'll have that up when we get it. But for now, we got to move on to more news. Ridley Scott is getting his Napoleon Director's Cut, featuring 48 minutes of unseen footage. Napoleon the Director's Cut is now streaming on Apple TV Plus. This is kind of a big story for Ridley Scott. Obviously, the auteur is big on making his own projects, right? And he'd said when Napoleon came out that he had like a 4.5-hour cut of the movie that didn't make it to theaters, that he wanted to do something with it. It seems like despite the fact that Napoleon lost money, Apple is making good on that and they're giving him the opportunity to have a director's cut. Is this an exciting feature for a streamer to be premiering for future directors, or what do you think? Are they just giving him his flowers? Like what are we doing here? And more importantly, who's watching Napoleon the director's cut?
Napoleon heads rejoice for sure. A full hour of this movie. I mean, this movie was too long as it was, which I think it came in at about 2.5 hours when it originally came out. Another hour of it seems excessive. I don't know what we're getting more of. Probably maybe some longer battle sequences, maybe some more crucial scenes of the drama. That movie's too long as it is. I can't imagine wanting to watch almost another hour of it. It's cool that Apple let him do this, and I mean, because it does make more sense if you're going to have something that long. It's easier viewing at home, so that's probably a little bit easier draw. But yeah, I don't know who's watching this.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I did like Napoleon when we caught it last Thanksgiving. Empire reports that this additional cut features more of Josephine's life before she meets Napoleon. That's Vanessa Kirby's character, who's great in the movie. Joaquin Phoenix is great in the movie. I remember liking the battle sequences a lot. Like, but as somebody who liked Napoleon fine, A, I have not rewatched it, and B, I have no desire to add 48 minutes to that runtime. It seemed like a fine film on its own. Like, I know Ridley Scott likes to shoot big epic. I know he's got Gladiator 2 coming out this Thanksgiving, but I don't know. I don't know who is asking for this. But at the same time, I'm glad Apple's doing it. Like, I talk a lot about how it feels like DVD features have gone the way of the buffalo, right? And like, we can't get good director's commentaries anymore. Whatever happened to a director's cut? Apple's doing it. Like, here it is. They are giving us that thing. I just don't really want it for Napoleon, right? Do you?
Yeah, it's not a draw for me. And again, I don't think there's a physical release of Napoleon, is there, possibly?
I don't think so. I was just looking up whether or not they'd ever put out Killers of the Flower Moon, which they haven't. That still isn't a physical release.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're just getting the streamers are not super into the physical release, so it is nice if you're interested in it, if you really dug that movie or really wanted to dig in to see what Ridley Scott had to say in longer time, but it's not a draw for me.
Yeah, me too. Another story this week. Spider-Man 4 has a director, which is nuts, right? We weren't talking about Spider-Man 4 the last time we recorded. This was 2 weeks ago. Now here we are. Spider-Man 4 is in the news. Tom Holland's attached to star. And our director is another Marvel aficionado, though maybe not one you'd expect. Who do they got on deck to lead Spider-Man, Andy?
They have the one Destin Daniel Cretton, who did Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Which was, I think, probably the best of kind of this second wave of Marvel post-Endgame. Probably the best of those movies. And he was supposed to helm Avengers the Kang Dynasty, which we all know kind of how that went. No longer happening because of Jonathan Majors' legal troubles. So that whole entire project got scrapped, and as did the director. So he is back for Spider-Man 4. The writers, I think, are the same from the previous ones as well. I'm sure that, like, Spider-Man is always successful. I'm sure it'll be fine. The funny part is that Tom Holland desperately needs Spider-Man because he hasn't really done a whole lot of good projects outside of that. But I did hear some news today, though, that this might affect Beyond the Spider-Verse whenever the animated thing is supposed to come out, because, you know, they don't want competing Spider projects. This is supposed to start filming at the beginning of 2025 for probably a summer 26 or a Christmas 26 release date. And again, that's going to start running into Beyond the Spider-Verse timeline. So who knows when those two projects will actually come out.
We actually had a story in the outline about Sony having some trouble with Spider-Verse, but that's kind of been knocked out of the air just today when we're recording by Chris Miller, one of the directors, Phil Lord and Chris Miller? Yeah, who said that, no, everything's fine with Spider-Verse. It's still on track to come out. But you're right. Like, Sony does have to juggle those two properties. How does that affect this movie, if at all? For what it's worth, I do think Destin Daniel Cretton's a good pick. Hilariously, I keep referring to him as the disgraced director of the former Avengers Kang Dynasty, because it didn't happen. In no way his fault. As far as we know, he was good to shoot that film. And Shang-Chi was good. Yeah, it is one of the better of Marvel's kind of run of Marvel features during that time, when it wasn't after Avengers. It was after Avengers, but before, like, I don't know, anything real big. Shang-Chi's fine. I think he's a good pick for it. Like, people have been posting fight scenes from that movie and saying, man, think how good this is going to look when Spider-Man's swinging around. Like, totally see that. As for Tom Holland, I'm hopeful for the kid. I am. Like, I really am. I he can sing. He can dance. Oh, I think he can sing. He can dance. I know he's got that Fred Astaire biopic on the way that could be cool. Like, I don't know. Like, he's got the legs for it. But, man, this kid cannot seem to get a good project. Like, I don't know if it's his agent or what the deal is, but outside of Spider-Man, everything he's a part of just kind of wanes. Even that Romeo and Juliet theatrical he's been doing reportedly isn't that good. Like, oh, boy. You know, like, he's got to get... I don't know. He's got to get something. My man's got to get out from under Spider-Man. This can't be it for him.
If you're nothing without the role of Spider-Man, you don't deserve it.
Mm. Perfect. Should be the title of the episode. One more story this week. Beetlejuice scares up a near record $111 million domestic opening. Not the scariest thing at the box office, actually, because Alien Romulus also setting records in 2024. Andy, what's going on at the ticket sales, ticket window?
And it's a good September so far. Beetlejuice opening 110 million domestic. And this wasn't a super well-known project or property known internationally. So it hasn't really picked up a lot in international markets. But it's like the second biggest opening of September behind the first It from 2017. So it's doing really well. Alien Romulus has cleared 300 million. I was going to say they're not. It's not like us. What's the Blake Lively movie? It ends with us. It ends with us. They not like us. I almost said
they not like us.
It ends with us is just also crossed $300 million. So huge for that little movie. The little movie that could, misguided as it might be. So the leftovers are doing pretty well, and we have a big hit in Beetlejuice. 36 years after the original came out in 1988.
I can't believe it. I talked a lot of smack about Beetlejuice when it got announced. I figured, yeah, okay, they got that Beetlejuice musical that's doing fine, and occasionally I might see a clip or two on TikTok, but there's no way this franchise has the legs. Andy went back and rewatched the first film. It's not even that good. Like, you know, it's big effects, it's big visuals, it's big ideas, but it's strung together by a relatively thin plot and maybe even thinner characters. But somehow Beetlejuice is continuing to perform. Hasn't even opened in Germany and France and Japan yet. It's going to make more money over there. Seems like a big W, which is, I think, a good segue to talk about Beetlejuice, which is what we're about to get to. Before we do, though, any other thoughts on the box office, Andy? I know you're taking the summary on us, so I want to make sure you got room to breathe.
I think Beetlejuice will have some good legs. There's not really any competition the rest of the month. I mean, this is the biggest opening or the biggest movie of this month, actually. So I think they're going to coast to some pretty good numbers. And I'm sure we're going to get an announcement for the threequel, because that's just kind of how you do these things. Why not, when it's clearly so still beloved and people are interested in it?
Yeah, Hollywood Reporter says it's going to have some staying power to see whether or not it gets a third one. But, man, based on this first weekend, like, it almost seems inevitable, like there's more coming. Not to mention, not too bad of a Hollywood handoff. They got that Jenna Ortega in there. All of this, obviously, is good setup to talk about the film proper. So with that, we should probably just move into it. Andy's going to be taking the summary on this one. Andy, please take it away.
Beetlejuice. So like I said earlier, this is the long-awaited sequel to the 1988, let me get that right, Beetlejuice, which was originally directed by Tim Burton and starred a very young Winona Ryder, one of her early breakout roles, as well as Catherine O'Hara, who are all back in this new rendition. We find the Dietz family succumbing to tragedy at the beginning of the film. The grandfather, originally played by Jeffrey Jones, who's not in this film because of some legal troubles we're not going to get into on the show. His character has passed away. This brings the family together and back to the town of Winterhaven. We find the family a little dysfunctional. Lydia Deeds, played by Winona Ryder, is kind of a ghostly medium. She has a TV show and is an internet personality. That's how she pays the bills. She kind of can convene with the dead. She has this very kind of vulturous husband or romantic interest, played by Justin Theroux, who's clearly in it for the money. She is estranged from her daughter Astrid, played by Jenna Ortega, really bringing in that Gen Z crowd. They don't get along. They're kind of in that teenage daughter mother dynamic, not getting along, very dysfunctional. And of course, Catherine O'Hara is the mother, is a delight. There's a lot going on plot wise, so I'm not going to try to get into it too much. I just want to kind of set up our dynamic. In the meantime, we also have the afterlife. Things going on there where Beetlejuice himself, played of course by Michael Keaton, is just kind of there. But we see the revival of his long dead wife, played by Monica Bellucci, in this great Bride of Frankenstein kind of getup. And we also have some special guests like Willem Dafoe as an actor turned cop turned actor, who's on the case to try to solve all these things. There is a lot going on. There's a lot of plot lines. But this movie's all about vibes and joke. It's a joke a minute kind of thing. There's lots of laughs. There's highly, highly entertaining. I definitely enjoyed it more than I thought I would, because I did not like the original. I watched it about a few months ago, very recently, and then thought, I guess it's a product of its time. But I actually really enjoyed this and I'm excited to get into it. Zach, what'd you think?
So I was not warm going into Beetlejuice. I was skeptical. I figured, man, it's been over a decade since I've seen Tim Burton put out anything that really impressed me. I know Wednesday got a lot of good vibes, but I don't know. I just figured it was a miniseries. Like, I was curious to see what he was going to do on the big screen. And I'm very pleased to report, I think this is Tim Burton's best movie in over a decade, for sure. Potentially two decades. Like, it is such a welcome return to form for the wild-haired director who just has wild, even wilder ideas. Huge visuals, whack lighting, way too many characters. Beetlejuice is good. Like, fun settings, pretty good script. Michael Keaton's back. I mean, you get everybody back for it. Like, I can't believe I liked it as much as I did. I might potentially like it. Probably don't like it more than the first one. I think the first one's got some good stuff going on in it. But really looking forward to talking about this, because I every once in a while, a movie comes along and surprises you on this podcast. And let me tell you, Beetlejuice is the movie of the month for me. Like, I did not think this was going to be as good as it was. I feel like I've heard mixed reviews from people. I'm excited to clear the air and explain to you all why this is a good movie. So where do you want to jump in and talk about it, Andy?
Well, let's talk about our big cast. So I was afraid this movie might just be a nostalgia fest. And it wasn't. And it really wasn't. It really tries hard at being its own thing, not being too of the time either. It also doesn't have a bunch of like Gen Z jokes, or there's like one joke about influencers. But it's really kind of an original comedy about this dysfunctional family, about the afterlife. It's a dark comedy. But Michael Keaton's great. He still has the juice for lack of a better term. He really does. And Catherine O'Hara, same character. I mean, she's so good in everything. Jenna Ortega isn't in this as much as I thought she might be, but she's fine. Winona Ryder just picking up the role like she never left it, and some really, again, funny additions. Willem Dafoe's Wolf Jackson steals the scene every time. Monica Bellucci, she's interesting. Her character's not really in it. Again, there's so many plot lines interweaving and so many people, but the makeup and like the sets are so good that you just go with it. Again, the vibes are good and it's not too long. It's like 100 minutes.
Yeah. O'Hara steals every scene she's in, which is hilarious. I love that Justin Theroux's kind of doting husband slash talent manager Rory literally attacks people with therapy speak, which is incredible. And I haven't seen a character doing that in a minute on screen, like actually really refreshing and a very real problem. And I like that Lydia Deetz is kind of a stand-in for what feels like Burton's larger work, right? Like she's somebody who had all these big visions and big dreams and was able to see these ghosts in her past, like able to see these huge things from the afterlife. And since then, she's monetized it and dumbed it down and gone to TV and just become kind of this like shell of what she used to be. And she has to realize over the course of the movie that like really she should be looking to like go back to those big things instead of like being haunted by them. There's this big line at the end that I think is really fitting. And that comes into Burton's work here, like not only between the practical effects and general pacing, but the overall tone of this movie is delightful. I love the way Burton looks at the afterlife. Like I feel like so often death is seen as A, frightening, or B, something we shouldn't be presenting to children, or C, maybe kind of peaceful, right? Like the Pixar afterlife. Take me to like Coco, like the land of the dead, or even like Soul, right? Like these kind of luminous beings are we. And Tim Burton's afterlife, meanwhile, is like horribly grisly and full of body horror and wildly messy and sometimes scary, but also like fun. And it makes light of it, and it presents death as kind of another life past life, the afterlife, another journey, another thing. Like, and it makes it easy. Characters die in Beetlejuice, and it doesn't hurt the film at all. Like, it kind of works better. You don't feel as much sorrow for them as like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. We're on to our next thing. And like, I think that's a good lesson for kids. Like, I think the world Tim Burton presents is a good alternate view of what we're normally presented with. And like, nobody does it quite like him. It's very refreshing to see him returning to this and doing it well and sticking the landing. It's really nice.
Yeah, again, the characters work so well. Just, like, the vibes of everything. Like, it's genuinely so funny. Like, my whole audience was cracking up. I was cracking up. And there's so... It's a gag a minute. Visual gags, other kinds of jokes. And it's just a good time. And that is, I think, is a good time to get into the plot. The plots are a little confusing. So I'll try to just outline the premise of a lot of things. So... Again, the grandfather character dies. This brings everyone back to the original house and town from the original Beetlejuice. But we have Winona Ryder and her love interest, who's clearly trying to just be on her coattails to wealth. Delia Deetz, Catherine O'Hara's character, is just kind of her version of mourning is creating weird art, which is really funny. We have Jenna Ortega not only being estranged from her mom, but also starting this new school. She meets a boy, so there's a little bit of that teenage angst going on. Again, we have Monica Bellucci's character coming after Beetlejuice. We have William Dafoe, the detective, trying to find Monica Bellucci's character. It's just like, are you keeping up with all this? And I still don't think that that's all of them. And somehow this works. And in a lot of movies, it would just fall apart. And in this, it kind of does, but you don't care because it's just so fun the entire time.
Yeah, it doesn't waste any time in the runtime. Like, I do think it has probably one or two too many plot lines. You could easily cut two or three of these characters and the film would still work fine. But with so many, you don't get enough time for you to get bored anywhere. And combine that with like zany camera angles and whack lighting and the insane presentation of the underworld in combination with an overworld that is not all entirely normal. Like, I do love the look of this little town they shoot in. Whoever decided to cover the OG Beetlejuice house in this like black mourning shroud is genius. Like, it's such a cool look. It gives the whole film this like unique feeling all its own. Like, all of that gives you so much visually to chew on that you don't have time to get bored anywhere, and before you know it, you're in your third act and then you're rolling towards credits. Obviously the movie still has to hit a lot of like nostalgia set pieces, which Beetlejuice is full of, right? You got to see the sandworm that's inspired by Dune, which is a weird watch now, having seen Dune 1 and 2, right? You got to get like some kind of, you got to get Deo, the song in there, right? And you got to have probably some kind of scene where a bunch of people are possessed and singing. You got to have the guys with the shrunken heads. All of these things need to make an appearance in Beetlejuice. The secret, I think, is peppering all of these things in without making them ham-fisted callbacks and making them feel like a natural extension of the universe. Burton manages to do this. Like, it doesn't feel like it overstays its welcome. It feels fresh. It feels new. And if anything, because so much of it is practical, it genuinely feels like a fresh experience. So much of this from another director would have been CGI junk. It would have been blurry effects in a half-lit room that you can't really see, and your brain would tell you, yeah, I guess that character just transformed from a bat into a person. But Burton, meanwhile, is like, no, we're going to do some crazy moves of a whip pan, and we're going to like throw up some lights and some smoke, and they're going to turn into a thing. And it makes it feel different, and it makes it feel fun, and it makes it feel new, even though it is uniquely nostalgic. I'm really impressed. It was really a delight watching a lot of this stuff pop up on screen. And it's just like, it's a gag a minute. It's a bit a minute. It's an effect a minute. Like, I can't believe how fast they keep coming at you.
Yeah, and I think what you were talking about, the sets and things like costume and makeup, make it work so well because it's largely practical. You know, there's some digital effects here and there, but it's not, you know, they could have easily gone for some big third act thing in the underworld where there's all these demons and whatever else flying around. But they keep it very grounded. And I think it's the kind of thing that will have staying power, that will have rewatchability. Because when I think of something like Deadpool and Wolverine, like, it was fine and it was funny, but it's very much of the moment, and that movie's not going to really be relevant in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, whereas, like, this is one of these things that you can probably just watch every Halloween, you know, till Kingdom Come.
Yeah, that's exactly what this feels like. Potentially like a new holiday staple. It reminds me a lot of Violent Night, David Harbour Santa movie that came out a couple years ago. We walked out of the theater for that. I thought I could see myself watching this every December. Same with Beetlejuice. This feels like an October watch. Like, you could easily throw this on the watch list for movies you want to watch in October. You could throw this on at a party and keep it running in the background, like, visually distinct. A lot of characters you like. Again, Catherine O'Hara literally steals every scene she's in. It's a great time. Like, I can't believe I'm saying it's a great time. And I tell you, man, I really did think Burton might be washed. I really thought after his Disney run, after bringing in the renaissance of Disney live action with his Alice in Wonderland films, and then he did Dumbo, which everybody said was a big miss. Like, I figured he was out. He wasn't doing this anymore. He'd gone the way of, like, Kevin Smith, right? He will not return to the Viewisk universe. It is what it is. And not only does he seem to be back, he may be back with a vengeance. If he produces another film like this next, I think we may be looking at almost like a George Miller style renaissance, right? Returning to what made you great. Dude, bring it on. There's way too many people like Tim Burns. He polls high with millennials, I'm told. That's what I've heard. So I think Burton, he might have something here. And again, I can't believe Keaton can keep it up at like 7. How old is he? 76? It's a lot of voice work. Admittedly, it's not as much physical in this film, but he's only in, what, 17 minutes of the movie. They explicitly kept him cut back, just like in the first film, because they wanted him to be almost like a Hannibal Lecter presence in the film. It's not all, it can't be Beetlejuice for 110 minutes. It's got to be other characters. He's just there. He's an accessory to this whole thing. I'm really stunned at how well it works. It's not a perfect film. It may not make the top 10 list, but man, Beetlejuice is a fun ride. So with that, any other thoughts or recommendations?
I wanted to mention the score and needle drops in this are really good. Again, we get the classic Beetlejuice theme, which is a big part of that first movie, and in this, it'll put a smile on your face when you see it. But then the pop tunes that are chosen are really solid. It's the perfect cue of classic, like, 70s, 80s tunes that are used in here. Really good soundtrack that ties into the movie really well, and just, again, helps it work.
Yeah. I was actually really pleased to hear that, like, Danny Elfman score in the front with, like, a million instruments all going at once. Bah, 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 bah. Like, it's good stuff. Yeah, Danny Elfman's great. The miniatures are great. And it doesn't overstay its welcome. This movie easily could have been 2 hours, 10 minutes, like, in the wrong hands. And, like, it ends up being, like, a tight hundy, doesn't have too many nostalgia throwbacks, doesn't go out of its way to, like, step over here and say, look, parents, remember when you saw this when you were kids? Like, it's really nice. Not too many member berries. Genuinely seems to be focused on just telling an interesting story with the elements you've got here. And, like, that's the best you can hope for a nostalgia sequel. So with that, Andy, would you recommend Beetlejuice?
Yeah, absolutely would. This was a wonderful surprise. I had a lot of fun. There's jokes, there's vibes, there's a lot of fun characters. There's a few too many plot lines that going on at once, but like you don't even care just because everything that's on screen is just so funny. You're laughing the whole time. It's got a little bit of nostalgia bits, but it doesn't do it too heavily, and it also isn't trying to be too contemporary either. I think it's a surprisingly a big hit. Highly recommend.
Yeah, same. I think Beetlejuice rocks. I think it's Tim Burton's best movie in over a decade. I know I keep saying that, but I mean it. You can look him up on IMDb. Like, it's pretty slim, man. Like, this is a genuine return to form for the director. I can't wait to see what he does next. I hope he does more work like this. Please do not go do mainstream junk. Please do not just take a check and go do whatever somebody tells you. Like, go do another weird movie again, please. Like, he is so good at doing weird movies. Beetlejuice is a weird one for sure. And with that, we should move into our next segment of the episode. Andy, what do we typically call this one?
It's time for the trailer park.
Perfect. And I'm going to be taking the first summary here. First film we're looking at, four films on the trailer park this week. Night Bitch, which, boy, is as much fun to say as it is to watch, I hope. Yeah, from Searchlight Pictures. Night Bitch is the new Amy Adams feature. Amy Adams stars as a young mom who's paused her career to be a stay-at-home mom. But she suddenly begins to find she stays at home with her newborn and her husband goes off to work that things are not all as they seem. And the other mom groups are kind of odd to her, and she starts to feel some odd urges. And before she knows it, she's out running with the dogs at night as her domesticity takes a surreal turn. We had heard about this script a while back and we thought it sounded whack. And let me tell you, looking at the trailer, it's surreal, but it looks visually grounded. Amy Adams is definitely doing something in it. Andy, what do you think of the trailer for Night Bitch?
So I'd heard a little bit of buzz about this. Just the concept seemed really interesting. Seemed like it could be real subversive, surreal, premise. The book was a big hit, came out a couple of years ago by Rachel Yoder. This trailer looks awful though. Like, it did not capture it. Reminded me of that Charlize Theron movie where she's a mom, also a Tully, I think, something like that. It's an interesting idea of her, you know, kind of becoming an animal, but it just looks like the very like watered down version, or like family-friendly version of this. I mean, I assume this is probably going to be rated R, but maybe not. But it just looks like a really watered-down idea. And sometimes this happens in Hollywood where you get this great book and then they water it down for general audiences. And that looks like what's happening here. And some of the reviews out of the film festivals have said that, you know, it's really, it has very surface-level read. Apparently the book is supposed to also be a commentary on, like, motherhood and womanhood and things like this. And apparently all those themes are just kind of very surface-level and watered down in the film. So I feel like Amy Adams can't make a good movie to save her life these days.
I know. I just like Tom Holland. I'm like, girl, you need new representation. You got a lot of talent. Like, you gotta get somebody out there who's going to get you in the room, that's going to get you big roles, because this is not doing it. But, you know, hey, we've seen weird stuff on the podcast before. We might end up watching Night Bitch. I'll be the first to say that I've been surprised by films that I thought were going to be lame and turned out to be cool. All right. For all I know, it's a banger. Go check out the trailer for Night Bitch. Let us know what you think. What's next, Andy?
A Minecraft movie. Not the Minecraft movie, a Minecraft movie. Implying maybe there will be more to come. So this is the first of many toy properties that are being turned into full feature-length films. Part of this looks good. This stars Jack Black, Jason Momoa, Emma Myers. And this is one of those things where, like, kids or this group of people get sucked into a video game, I think. The video game stuff looks great. Like, the world building, like, the Minecraft stuff looks pretty fun and awesome. And the human characters look so out of place. Like, this looks like, oh, you're filming on sound stages, and it just looks super lame. I don't know why they didn't just go with, like, square people. Maybe they needed faces to sell the movie, but I think the animation looks good. The rest of it kind of looks lame, but it'll be interesting to see when a full trailer comes out, and maybe we'll get some more of the premise.
I feel like people have been hammering the Minecraft movie trailer, a Minecraft movie trailer, like they did the OG, like, Sonic trailers from Paramount. Like, this looks terrible. You guys are missing the mark. And my favorite pieces of criticism come from Twitter, as they usually do. this is the laziest way to make a video game movie. Real people get sucked into video game world is the laziest possible way to make a video game movie. Couldn't be lazier, right? Like, it is the most basic, droll, trite thing. You've seen it a dozen times. And for everybody out there that's like, well, it's not made for you. It's made for babies. Yes, of course it is. That's the second laziest way to make a video game movie, right? Like, you can't make anybody angry if it's made for nobody who can put together a rational thought. Same with the Super Mario Brothers movie. Like, that's fine, right? Like, I get this is made for kids. But honestly, the lighting looks awful. The cast looks like a joke. Everyone's got frizzy hair for some reason. And Jack Black in no way is playing Steve from Minecraft. He's playing Jack Black, who looks like he's played Minecraft before and understands that he is Steve from the Mojang game Minecraft. Like, it just looks bad, dude. I think it looks really bad. I do think the effects look good. If the whole movie was that, I think you'd have maybe a stronger base to run on. Boy, I hope they can iron this one out in editing before it comes out. That's what I think. Also, it'll make $1 billion. Let me be clear. While I say this looks creatively bankrupt, this movie will make $1 billion. So, you know, that's the Minecraft movie. What do you think, Andy?
I think it will be successful. I don't know why you don't go with some sort of younger actors that you know, because Minecraft is largely a kind of a kid's game. So why don't you go someone that's not 50-year-old Jack Black? To play like this, the lead, well-known character from that thing. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they turn into square people later. Maybe that would work. I don't know.
That would be nuts. Yeah.
I'm sure it'll be fine because it's such a safe and well-known property, but man, it looks like movie for babies.
Yeah, like I remember when Rob McElhenney from Sonny was attached to direct this and it had like a $150 million budget and they were like putting together all that, and now it's like just trudging out and everybody thinks it looks meek and it's like, okay, yeah, here's the Minecraft movie a decade too late. Anyway, another trailer we got to talk about this week. Wolfman. This is the new Leigh Whannell picture, everybody's favorite Jigsaw victim. Following The Invisible Man, which he did with Blumhouse Pictures, to rip-roaring success, actually. Everybody liked that movie, including us. We covered it here on the podcast. Wolfman is the next in the Universal monster horror movie. We got a loose teaser trailer for it. And let me tell you, I don't know why Universal and Blumhouse decided to just put out like a teaser for this and then tell everybody exactly what happens in the whole movie. But if you don't want to know exactly what happens in this movie, don't read the YouTube description or really any IMDb description. I'll keep it tight for you. A family travels out to the woods to get away one weekend, and the father, played by Christopher Abbott, realizes there is something strange and dangerous out in those woods. His wife, Julia Garner, also figures out something's wrong, and their young daughter is there with them. The man gets attacked, and then when they hole up in the house for the evening, then this thing is outside. That's when they just begin to discover that maybe something is going on with the husband character, and things may not be all as they seem. The teaser is very Alien inspired. They do the same thing with the logo, where like little parts of the letters pop up over the whole screen before it fills out. And there's a bit of nature stuff in the open with like a wasp and a praying mantis fighting. So between that and Alien, I'm presuming Wannell's leaning big on the like the natural order of things, right? Evolution. That's kind of the lean, but maybe I'm overreading it. What do you think of the teaser for Wolfman?
I really dug this. This looked really pretty scary, actually. Because it's got that, it's a little bit of a zombie thing where I guess Christopher Abbott's character gets bit by something and becomes said Wolfman. And it's a lot of that, like, you know, classic car stuff, chasing someone trying to get the car started. Julia Garner's going to be a great scream queen for this. Yeah, this looks like the terrifying kind of horror. And yeah, we enjoyed The Invisible Man. That was actually the last movie I saw before the pandemic, before we went into lockdown.
Oh, yeah. Everybody remembers the last. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I'm surprised it's taken this long to do a follow-up, though, because, you know, there was rumors that Blumhouse was supposed to, you know, kind of create the dark universe that had been attempted before, so where we would have, like, The Invisible Man, The Wolf Man, Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, like, the whole team up. So I wonder if we'll see... The Invisible Man character played by, now I can't remember her name, the woman in that. Anyway,
I know. She's Peggy in Mad Men. She's great. I got to look her up. Hold on.
Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah. Love her.
So I wonder if she'll show up in The Wolfman as well.
Probably. One more for us. What do you got, Andy?
This just came out today. The Apprentice, which is this biopic of Donald Trump, which has been very controversial. The Trump Organization has actually been trying to stifle this movie and stop it from coming out. Like they tried to do a lawsuit and all this stuff. No studio wanted to touch this. Like no one wanted to put it out, but they were able to find a distributor, and the Trump campaign actually, they backed off of the movie. They're just, it's going to be what it's going to be. This is coming out like a few weeks before the election, which is kind of crazy, but it's going to start. It stars Sebastian Stan as Donald Trump and Jeremy Strong as Roy Cohn, his kind of ruthless lawyer, teaching him the ropes in 1980s, 1990s, America, New York, about how do you become a ruthless real estate mogul, you know? And the whole thing is like lie, deny everything. You want to win, you got to do everything. Like, is that kind of, it's filmed in a very kind of like documentary style, almost like The Office kind of. Sebastian Stan gets the look right. He's not really going for a voice, which I don't know if that's a good or bad idea. We'll see. Well, I have to see, but I think I'm looking forward to this for sure.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to this. I'm a big Succession fan, so functionally anything Jeremy Strong's in, I'll go see, sight unseen. He looks delightful as Roy Cohn, this like horrible, twisted man who doesn't trust anybody and will win at any cost, which is perfect for young Donald Trump, Sebastian Stan, with the blonde hair, who isn't really doing a voice. I do think younger Trump didn't have too much of a voice back in the day. Like, he was a bit meeker then, so I don't mind it too much. Also, Maria Bakalova as, I'm assuming, Ivana. One of his part. Yeah, it was Ivana. I was going to say somebody in his life, right? Like, seems like a W for me. Putting this out during election season seems nuts. I mean, shout out to who's producing it, Lionsgate? I don't know who actually got the deal to put this out, but like, whoever did, boy, you guys are... You're stepping on a landmine with this one. It's either going to be good or bad, I guess. I don't know. Or you know, it'll come out in small theaters. Some people will see it, and then nobody will see it. We'll see what happens. Before it's worth, like, I am looking forward to The Apprentice. This looks like weird, bold, supervillain era story cinema stuff that I can get into. So, yeah, that's the trailer park. Four trailers worth watching. Any other thoughts on these before we move on to Rebel Ridge, Andy?
Just a lot of good stuff coming up in the next few months. September's a little dry, but it'll be interesting. And this is, I mean, these are supposed to be like awards contenders, a lot of these. So we'll see how that plays out for people like Amy Adams and Sebastian Stan.
Yeah, we definitely will. With that, we should jump into the final film of the episode. I'm going to be taking the summer in this one, so please excuse any clumsy delivery. The film is Rebel Ridge. So, in Rebel Ridge, an ex-Marine grapples his way through a web of small-town corruption when he rides into town on his bicycle with bail for his cousin, and unfortunately, things begin to escalate into a violent standoff with a local police chief. Film stars Aaron Pierre as our lead, Terry Richmond, Don Johnson as Chief Sandy Byrne, and Anna Sophia Robb as Summer McBride, a supporting character who I did not know was in this movie and did not expect and couldn't place for half the film until I realized, wait a second, that's that girl from Bridge of Terabithia, son of a gun. Rebel Ridge has been making the rounds on Netflix this week. To big acclaim, I think people have been surprised at how good it is, and that's because it's from director and writer Jeremy Saulnier, who directed Green Room, right? A film we covered on, I think we covered Green Room on this show, and was delightful. A bottle thriller, right? Like dark and twisted, but fun, small town, unique. And now Rebel Ridge is his first film in a few years, and it's got a lot of that same energy, inspired by something like Rambo and First Blood. It is a unique story of two forces meeting against one another, using the judicial system as a bit of cannon fodder between the two of them. It's exciting, it's bloody, it's unique. Rebel Ridge is a surprisingly good time. Andy, what'd you think?
Yeah, I was surprised about this too. I had heard some buzz on film Twitter about it. Decided to check it out. It has a lot going for it. It's this kind of a. It has a little bit of a, like a Hallmark movie setup where you have this small town. There's corruption going on in the police force, and this ex-military guy is ends up crossing swords with them, taking on the little guy, taking on the corrupt police force. It's a story we've seen a ton of times. It's handled a lot differently. It's got a lot of thriller elements. It has action sequences, but it's not overly concerned with them. We have good situation development, character development. It's a little bit too long. It overstays. It's welcome, but it hits more than it misses.
Yeah, I was really impressed by Rebel Ridge. We were kind of looking for something else to watch in the pod, and we needed something to fill in, a streamer, and Andy mentioned it just about a week ago. Like, hey, this movie's been kind of been blowing up on Twitter, Rebel Ridge. Like, you want to check it out? And I said, oh, yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah, we should watch that. I'm really pleased we did. Every once in a while, a streamer puts out a film that you don't really hear anything about that actually turns out to be really solid. This is one of those. Rebel Ridge is a good time. Though, admittedly, like Andy said, bit long in the middle. I didn't really expect, but an explosive opening act, which I'm looking forward to talking about. Terry, right, ex-Marine, rides into town on his motorcycle. Within the first couple minutes of the film, he is immediately apprehended by police and has his belongings taken from him, and he's arrested. It's a very, very quick start, much faster than First Blood, starring Stallone back in the day. These two cops are kind of up to no good, and explain that we're keeping your cash because we think it might be in connection with drug paraphernalia. He's quite upset. He rides to the courthouse to try to get it sorted out. They tell him, we can't really help you. He goes back to the police station. They kind of get into it. That's functionally your first act. It is very quick and very exciting, and it's got a lot of action and a lot of tension, and all of this is held down by Aaron Pierre, star of the film. We have seen him previously in one other film on this podcast, Old. He plays mid-sized sedan in Old, the M. Night Shyamalan feature. I can't believe it. I couldn't place him watching the movie, but let me tell you, Pierre is excellent. Excellent in this movie. Instant star material. I've seen people talk about them casting him for what's his name? One of the Green Lanterns in that HBO show after seeing him in this movie. He's stern. He's serious. He manages to have this level of like bubbling rage under this controlled expression throughout nearly the entire film. He's physical when he needs to be. He can attack. He can defend. And most uniquely, he can hold a position of power while seeming and appearing to be relaxed, which tells the other people in the scene around him to also be relaxed when he is holding up, let's say, a police station in the film. Everybody seems to be cool and non-aggressive, even though he is very obviously the one in control. The film's tagline, "Their Laws, His Rules," uniquely applies to the characters of Rebel Ridge, because Terry, played by Aaron Pierre, is stellar. Also plays opposite Don Johnson, who is the police chief, who we most recently saw in Knives Out. Don Johnson is a ton of fun as this kind of not so straight-laced police chief who might have a little something going on more than meets the eye that maybe people don't want to know about. He goes opposite Aaron Pierre perfectly. The two of them play off each other great. You get a supporting cast of characters, including Anna Safari Robb, who's kind of a vulnerable mom who's stuck in a unique situation where she can't really decide what's best for her, and you end up having a pretty solid 2-hour movie. Admittedly a little long at 2 hours 11 minutes, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah, so much of this works pretty well. Aaron Pierre, he has such great screen presence. He's got the ex-military physique. There's a lot of different kinds of combat that go on. There's gunplay, there's hand-to-hand combat, and he uses all his ex-military skills to get things done. But he's not just like, he doesn't just start blasting. He's not just there to start shooting people or beat people up. He's trying to talk his way through things, but his hand is forced in several things. And we discover that there's corruption, but it's more complicated than it might appear on the surface. There might be a lot more going on. It gets a little convoluted plot-wise as far as Aaron Pierre's character. Like, he's trying to bail his brother or his cousin out of jail because he's supposed to be a witness in a big trial, something like that. It gets a little in the weeds that way, but it's all about the standoffs. You know, it's the taking on the corrupt police force. And we get these brilliant standoffs where everyone's got people, both sides have cards to play, and it's a question of how can you play them and who's got power when. That, you know, it's not just about shootouts. A really great tense moment at the end of the first act with the police station and Don Johnson. Don Johnson is so good in this. He's such a great villain character. So it's got a lot going for it, and I think the casting is real strong. It does have that, like, whenever I see a good movie on Netflix, I just wish it had been made by a better studio, because it does feel very small. And that probably helps it in some ways, because you don't have bad CGI, because you don't really have CGI, and like the sets are all, you know, you got like the police station, you got the courthouse, you got another place. There's a lot of cars, like cars crashing into each other. So, you know, you don't have like flying spaceships and things like that. So they keep it small, and that helps the Netflix of it all. But it's one of those things you could tell with more polish, you could have had a really great movie.
Yeah, I think this is a really, really great return to form for Jeremy Saulnier. Like, I know it's been a minute since he's made any big theatricals, and this isn't quite a big theatrical, but this is the closest you can get, I think, without going all the way. I hope he gets some funding from a bigger studio in the future, or maybe Netflix gives him another film and does that weird, like, 1 week in theater thing that they did for Rian Johnson in his last couple movies. I don't know what stands for him next, but this is solid. Rebel Ridge is a solid feature. If anything, I think a little long in the tooth in the middle for sure. After the first act, I thought, dude, this movie could do no wrong. And it turns out it's got a couple big action set pieces in the front, and then a bit of a lull where it's a whole lot of talking about corruption, and it's a whole lot of, well, you telling me that this DA was paid off, but not ever showing me the DA was paid off. And then I got to figure out who the DA is, and there's a secret somebody who's giving them hints. Like, all that gets to be a little messy. None of that matters when it comes down to the action, which is easily the best part of the feature. Like, that is what everything is building towards. It is a boiler pot of a thriller, and it's very satisfying once it gets where it needs to go. I think, if anything, I'm surprised that, A, I haven't heard much about it in marketing, and B, the name is so generic. We were talking about this before we started recording. Like, the name Rebel Ridge means, I don't think, anything in the film. I don't even know. Like, is there a location called Rebel Ridge? Because it doesn't...
There's a location called Rebel Ridge, but it ends up being very inconsequential. So I was like, why was this called this?
Right.
Yeah. They definitely could have come up with a better name. Like I said, when I see a good Netflix movie, a lot of times I just wish it was made by someone else. But it was definitely, you got a good director, you have good performances. The script probably needed some more polishing. It definitely needed to cut some time. This 2 hours, 10 minutes would have been fine at an hour 50, hour 45 would have been, I think, a lot better. I haven't seen Anna Sophia Robb in, like, she's a working actress, but she just doesn't do a ton of movies. She does a lot of TV as well. But yeah, I was like, oh, she's from Bridge to Terabithia.
Yeah, yeah. I was always remember her as the girl from Bridge to Terabithia. How odd. No, same. Any other thoughts or recommendations, Andy? I don't have much more to say about it.
No, not for me. The action works really well. I will say that there are a lot of standoffs, and the first like two or three are like really riveting, and then when it happens like fourth and fifth times, you're like, okay, can we let's get on with it.
Yes. I think you could have cut 20 minutes out of this movie and it would have worked fine. Andy, would you recommend Rebel Ridge?
Yeah, I would. It's a good time. It's an, you know, action thriller, kind of a classic story. It reminded me of Walking Tall, the Dwayne Johnson movie, where he kind of does the same thing, taking on the evil corporation. The movie doesn't go where you think it's going to go. It does set up a lot of reasons for us to have good action, but a lot of the corruption, the conspiracy, what's going on, really going on behind the scenes, is not quite what you might think. And I was definitely, you know, excited to learn more and more about, like, oh, what's really going on? Because a lot of times you would just have a standoff, or I'm just going to, you know, off you and that's it. But there's several times when our main character is allowed to leave, and they're just like, you know, if you could just get out of here and never come back, like, we'd be fine. So it definitely takes some different turns. But yeah, I would recommend it. It's just a little bit too long.
Yeah, same. Rebel Ridge is a lot of fun. A little long in the tooth. The middle bit is where you'll be getting up and doing laundry, but the beginning and the end, rock solid. Still some action in the middle there. It's not all bad. Aaron Pierre, instant star. I want to see what he's in next. He's great. We should get Anna Sophia Robbins some more stuff. Couple crooked cops in here. Don Johnson's great. Can't go wrong, right? Vet versus cops. Love it. Love Rebel Ridge. Great time. And God, that's episode 266 of Off-Script Film Review. Already well and done behind us. Andy, what are we watching next week?
We are going to take the plunge and watch Horizon, an American Saga Chapter 1, which is now on, which is now streaming on Max. There's not a whole lot out. We were saying September is light. The big release this week is Speak No Evil, the James McAvoy thriller, which also stars Mackenzie Davis and Scoot McNairy. I've seen so many trailers for this, but it just looks like a movie we've all seen a thousand times. So we don't have a lot of interest in it. And we're also going to be just seeing what else comes out, because like I said, there's lots on streaming, not much in the theaters. And in the coming weeks, we're going to be taking a look at The Substance, the horror movie with Demi Moore and Margaret Qualley. Transformers 1 is also coming out on September 20th. The animated film Wolfs, the Brad Pitt, George Clooney, Apple TV film, which I think is only going to be in theaters for about a week. So you're going to have to blink and catch that. And then, of course, at the end of the month, Megalopolis on September 27th. Love to see what that's all about. For next week, taking the plunge into 3 hours of Horizon and America's Saga Part 1.
It's on HBO. We can watch it in parts. That's probably the best way to do it. I'm sure Andy and I will sit down and watch the whole thing in one sitting and without any interruptions, including bathroom breaks, obviously. But if you don't want to watch Horizon for 3 hours but want to find out what we think about it, or maybe keep up with some other stuff we might be watching, we got Abigail over on Peacock. I know Night Swim is on Prime. Perfect Days is on Hulu. We got options. We got a backlog. We got stuff we're going to check out. It is TBA. All right, mystery movie next week. If you want to find out what we're doing, keep up with what's going on, or just keep up with your boys off script in general. Keep up with what's going on at the box office, what's happening at the movies. Best way to do that is to subscribe to the show on your favorite platform of choice, right? Whether you're an audio listener on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartMedia. If you're over on YouTube checking out the video, if you're seeing our clips in YouTube Shorts or on Instagram, you can follow us in all those usual places. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and we got a TikTok page somewhere, I think. All the usual social media stuff, we're available there. You can find our website, offscriptfilmreview.com, and you can mail us correspondence directly at mail@offscriptfilmreview.com. Email us, let us know what you think of the movies, let us know what you think's going on, and if it's good stuff, we'll read your correspondence live on the air. Woo! I say live as if this is a live show and isn't pre-recorded. It is. If you're hearing this, it's pre-recorded. But we're excited you're here, and we're glad you listened, so thanks for hanging out with us. We'll be back next week with more. I think Wednesday next week, because I'm a little tied down Tuesday. So Wednesday the 18th, off-script episode 267, Horizon coming hot to you. And that's episode 266 of Off-Script Film Review. From all of us at Off-Script, the home of bold cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.